The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Let's join in singing our gathering song, For All That Is Our Life. Two vocalists of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of San Francisco will lead us in singing. Watch the slides on your computer or mobile screen for the lyrics, and please, please sing along. Remember, no one can hear you, so if you hit a wrong note, come in late, cut out early, no one will know it but you.
For all that is our life, we sing our thanks and praise. For all life is a gift which we are called to use to build the common good and make our own days glad. For needs which others serve, for services we give, for work and its rewards, for hours of rest and love, we come with praise and thanks. For all that is our life, for sorrow we must bear, for failures, pain, and loss, for each new thing we learn, for fearful hours that pass, we come with praise and thanks. For all that is our life, for all
Amanda Udis Kessler is a writer, musician, and songwriter, and a member of the High Plains Church Unitarian Universalist in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Among her writings is a responsive reading, We Labor in Love. That reading seems fitting for this Labor Day weekend. Our guest, Maynard Cedar, will lead the reading, and our dear friend and TPUF member, Amy Nabet, will lead the responses. Please recite the responses along with Amy. The words will appear on your screen.
On Labor Day, we honor our work, physical and mental, paid and unpaid, joyous and heartbreaking.
We give thanks for work's gifts, suffer its difficulties, and strive to make labor just and joyous for all.
Our work can build our society, provide for our material needs, and give our life meaning.
We labor in gratitude.
Our work can damage our society and the planet, fail to sustain our material needs, and be meaningless.
We join together to create work that supports the well-being of all.
Our work can heal the world, help us understand who we are, and keep us safe.
We labor in joy.
Our work can harm the world, demean us, and expose us to danger.
We join together to create work that is safe and humane.
Our work can fill our days with accomplishments and our lives with stories.
We labor in love.
Our work can dissatisfy and alienate us, we may not be able to find enough work or any work.
We join together to create work that blesses us, all people, and the planet.
This Labor Day and all Labor Days to come.
May our work and all work serve humanity and all living beings.
Our guest speaker asked if we could share this morning a poem by Eugen Bertolt Friedrich Brecht, known professionally simply as Bertolt Brecht. Brecht was a German theater practitioner, a playwright, and a poet. He saw reform in the arts as a way to promote social and political reform. His most famous theatrical work is the Threepenny Opera. Now, you may not all be familiar with this unusual play, but I think you're probably familiar with the anti-hero of the play, Captain MacHeath, because that scoundrel worked his way into the popular imagination and the American songbook as the infamous Mac the Knife. In Brecht's poem, A Worker Reads History, Brecht does what he most loved to do: shift perspective on past and current events to challenge us with the ironies, the hypocrisies, and shortcomings of accustomed ways of looking at the world and its peoples. A Worker Reads History. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with names of kings. Was it the kings who hauled the craggy blocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who built the city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, that city glittering with gold, lived those who built it? In the evening when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go? Imperial Rome is full of arcs of triumph. Who reared them up? Over whom did the Caesars triumph? Byzantium lives in song. Were all her dwellings palaces? And even in Atlantis of the legend, the night the seas rushed in, the drowning men bellowed for their slaves. Young Alexander conquered India. He alone? Caesar beat the Gauls. Was there not even a cook in his army? Philip of Spain wept as his fleet was sunk and destroyed. Were there no other tears? Frederick the Great triumphed in the Seven Years' War. Who triumphed with him? Each page of victory, at whose expense the victory ball. Every 10 years a great man. Who paid the piper? So many particulars. So many questions. And now I turn our virtual pulpit over to our guest speaker, Maynard Seder. Maynard taught sociology at the State College of North Adams, Massachusetts from 1978 to 2010. He's published several books and many, many articles, mostly featuring the lives of working people, regional economic development, and the labor movement. His latest work is The Gritty Berkshires, A People's History from the Hoosac Tunnel to Mass MoCo. The Hoosac Tunnel was a railroad tunnel roughly 5 miles long, constructed between 1851 and 1873, a formidable project that earned the nickname the Bloody Pit because it claimed the lives of so many workers, in some cases under rather suspicious circumstances. MassMoCo refers to the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, which opened in 1999. I just received a copy of the book yesterday, and so haven't had a chance to delve deeply into it, but just browsing through it, I noted two things. One was the quality of the writing, and two, the meticulousness and depth of the scholarship that went into this book, which of course made my academic heart pound. And those two observations made me appreciate why this book received the 2020 Independent Publishers Book Award for Best Nonfiction Book on the Northeast region of the United States. I think there's a comment, one of the people who offered comment on the book says something which I think is very important to note today and before we hear Maynard. Cedar opens up issues that transcend Northern Berkshire County and shines a clarifying light on the ugly transformations that have, that have occurred all across the United States over the past half centuries as working class people have suffered at the hands of politicians, cultural elitists, and corporations that have abandoned workers in pursuit of greater and greater profits. He brilliantly engages the reader in a detailed local history that simultaneously opens one's mind to the tragedy that has resulted from the concentration of wealth in the hands of the super wealthy at the expense of regular people. So with that in mind, Maynard, welcome again to Thomas Paine, and it's all yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jerry. And I want to thank Larry for inviting me, Jerry and Mike for helping to deal with the technology and just to be here today. It's great to be here this morning. I see him listed as giving a sermon. It's the first time I've been listed anywhere as giving a sermon, though my students might have said that I've been doing that for many, many years. I wanted to start by looking at the cover of the book by W.E.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction in America, which he wrote in 1935. And the reason why I want to do that is because a lot of labor historians, when they talk about the great strikes in the United States, some of the earliest strikes, will talk about the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, the 8-hour day strike of 1886. But Du Bois, in writing his book in 1935, has a big chapter four, called The General Strike. And Du Bois argues the first general strike in the United States was the strike of former slaves leaving the plantations during the Civil War, not only leaving their work on the plantations and harming the South in doing so, but then going north and in the South as well and joining the Union Army. He says it was a strike on a wide basis against the conditions of work. It was a general strike that involved directly in the end, perhaps 500,000 people. They wanted to stop the economy of the plantation system. And to do that, they left the plantations and they transferred their labor to the Union Army and organized as a new labor force. So in doing so, Du Bois is arguing against a lot of Reconstruction historians at the time who saw the slaves and former slaves as really being passive, just sort of sitting back and waiting to get their freedom. And Du Bois sees them obviously as very, very active, not only in leaving the plantation, but then in joining the army, and with doing that, allowing the Civil War to be won in the North. I should add, as long as we're looking at the cover of Du Bois's book, I need to add something that he writes at the very end of the book. So at the very end, after observing what actually happened during Reconstruction and the end of Reconstruction and the beginning of Jim Crow, Du Bois has the following to say, and it's sort of emblematic as a lot of the racism that really, involved workers throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century. The union movement, labor movement, was not immune from the racism of American society. This is what Du Bois says towards the end of the book. So long as the Southern white laborers could be induced to prefer poverty to equality with the Negro, just so long was a labor movement in the South made impossible. What I'd like to do this morning is to divide up what I'm going to say into three different sections. First, to talk about the origins, the history of Labor Day and May Day, and then go on with just really sort of a thumbnail sketch of union history in the United States through World War II, and then finally look to see what's happened to unions and the labor movement since the end of World War II and where we are today. So this is the most famous sketch of laborers organizing and marching in New York in 1882, the first Monday in September in 1882. It's a celebration of workers that got started on that day, but it wasn't yet called Labor Day. And the workers gathering and enjoying themselves by marching and then picnicking was carried on in a tradition that goes back really to ancient times, medieval times, in which workers were honored, craftspeople were honored in various kinds of ways. It just so happened that these workers from the greater metropolitan New York area just decided to do it in the beginning of September. This is a drawing of the same march, September 1882, and you can see on the upper right the letters slavery, the past, and then also the present. So this is just 17 years since the end of the Civil War, and slavery is still on the minds of many people. And a lot of the workers during this time who were being pushed into factories referred to what was happening to them as a form of wage slavery. So that particular term remained with them. In 1884, there was a resolution from the Central Labor Union of New York to observe the first Monday in September as Labor Day. But by 1893, 25 states had declared it a holiday. And as Jerry mentioned before, in 1894, it became a national holiday. Around that time, a lot of workers were working 10-hour days, 6 days a week, with six unpaid holidays. And as probably many of you know, child labor was very common. In 1886, there was a huge movement for the 8-hour day. This would be a great bumper sticker: 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. That was the motto of the workers who were mobilizing and striking across the United States for an 8-hour day. The focus of a lot of workers was not so much on wages. Wages were important, but they also needed to have more time for themselves. So the struggle for the 8-hour day was important. It was pushed by the Federation of Craft Unions, the American Federation of Labor, which organized just on the basis of craft. So left off a lot of sort of semi-skilled laborers and quote unskilled laborers, though no one's really unskilled. And also was pushed by the Knights of Labor, a relatively new organization that organized people all across the spectrum, regardless of their skill. And the idea was that on May 1st, 1886, there would be a huge strike all across the nation for an 8-hour day. And a lot of workers struck even before that. On May 1st, the center of the movement was in Chicago. 30,000 strikers in Chicago took part in it. There was a big strike at McCormick Harvesters that made tractors. On May 3rd, police attacked the strikers and four were killed. The following day, there was a rally at Haymarket Square in Chicago against the police action. Towards the end of the rally, a bomb was thrown. A number of people were killed, including police. And the following day, dozens of people were arrested, socialists, anarchists, and eight anarchists were put on trial. All of them had alibis not being at the park at that particular time. They were very quickly brought to trial. Five were executed. One committed suicide. Two had their terms commuted. And public opinion in the United States, with a lot of help from the newspapers, the government, the police, corporations, turned against labor. There were protests all over Europe supporting the workers, but in the United States, for the most part, public opinion turned against them. And the interesting thing is that was the origin of May Day, and even though it began as an American event, it's celebrated mostly throughout the rest of the world, but not officially in the United States. This is the bottom of a monument to we're called the Haymarket Martyrs, who were killed, who were executed after the Haymarket, what's called the Haymarket Affair. In 1889, the International Socialist Congress in Paris designated May 1st as an 8-hour holiday of workers to be called International Workers' Day, ultimately May Day. That's an image of one of the posters for May Day. This is a May Day parade in Union Square, New York, 1913. And you can see the signs are in several different languages. This particular parade brought together representatives of 20 different nationalities. So, I mean, it's interesting. So even though May Day wasn't pushed, certainly by the government and the corporations, as a day to celebrate in the United States, a lot of these immigrants brought with them the knowledge and the socialist experience in Europe of what May Day was. There was a big strike wave in the United States after World War I. And just kind of what happened after World War II, after the strike wave, there was also repression brought on by President Wilson. They were often called the Palmer Raids because the Attorney General at the time was named Palmer, but they could just as well have been called the Wilson raids. A lot of immigrants who were deemed as being radicals were thrown out of the United States, including one of the most famous ones, Emma Goldman. Also after World War I, there were what came to be called, quote, race riots, which really were attacks by white mobs against blacks. And 2 years later, we have this quote from A. Philip Randolph, which again points to what Du Bois was talking about earlier. If employers can keep the white and black dogs on account of their race prejudice fighting over a bone, the yellow capitalist dog will get away with the bone of profits. As many of you may know, Randolph was the founder and future president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and he helped coordinate the 1963 March on Washington. This is a very interesting photo of the observation of Labor Day in a relatively small town in North Carolina called Gastonia. And it's an interesting photo because it's an interracial march. This is in 1934, and Gastonia had been famous 5 years earlier for a very big mill strike that was organized by a communist union. The strike was ultimately put down, but the sense of solidarity among the workers continued. And so this was their Labor Day observation, the beginning of September 1934, which was just before a huge nationwide strike among textile workers throughout the South, started in the South, it went through the mid-Atlantic areas, including Philadelphia, and all the way through New England. And this is the period of time Roosevelt was just elected previously. So there's a sort of sentiment within the United States, particularly among workers, that that things could change. And huge social movements were developing during that time, often led by communists, socialists, the unemployed, and beginning unionists. And you may remember, I don't think FDR was really FDR when he was first elected, but he became what we know FDR. And he always said, if you want something done, you have to push me. And he was pushed in many cases by these great social movements. This is a march of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in Decatur, Illinois in 1935. And I mean, I like this in part because that was my mother's union. But this is also the birth this year, the birth of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Up to this time, the major labor federation was the American Federation of Labor, which I mentioned earlier, organized by craft. So electricians, welders, carpenters, bricklayers, they each would have their own union, and they weren't interested in organizing those people who weren't parts of crafts. And in doing so, it tended to be a very white, non-immigrant organization with a fair amount of racism within many of those unions. So there were millions and millions of workers who were outside of the purview of the AFL that really wanted to be organized. And so out of some remnants of the AFL realizing it wasn't really working, they formed the Congress of Industrial Organizations. And their particular goal was to organize people across the entire industry. So everybody in the auto industry would be in one big union rather than to be separated by craft and to leave out those who didn't have a particular kind of craft. One of the strategies that the CIO unions used was the so-called sit-down strike. So rather than being outside striking and allowing the company to bring in scab workers, they sat down in the factories themselves. They didn't leave, realizing in part that probably the company wouldn't send in the troops to take them out because it might damage, they didn't care about damaging them, but damage machines and some of the products they were building. And that sit-down strike and that particular tactic started in 1933 in Akron among rubber workers. And this is a very famous picture from Flint, Michigan in 1937 at the beginning of a strike that will go on for a couple of months at the Fisher Body plant. And obviously to keep the strike going, they had to get help. You may have seen photos of workers dropping ropes out of windows and their wives and allies putting baskets of food at the bottom of the ropes and taking care so that they can survive for those months. And the goal really of the sit-down strike was to get union recognition. And they did get union recognition at the end of this particular strike. It wasn't just men in the auto industry, the rubber industry, steel, coal, and so on, that were striking for recognition, but also women workers. And this was a very famous strike in Detroit that started soon after the sit-down strikes in auto by Woolworth workers in Detroit. This particular case was more than 100 young women at one of 40 different Woolworth stores in Detroit. Woolworth was kind of the Walmart of its day. It had over 2,000 stores in the United States, Canada, and interestingly enough, in Cuba also. It employed 65,000 workers, almost all women. It was a very racist corporation. They didn't employ Black people at all, and it was very anti-union. So the women also engaged in a sit-down strike. They had to get help with food. They had to get help with bedding. They got help from musicians. And After 7 days, the strike was settled. They got wage increases and also union recognition. 5 hours after their strike started, Kresge, a similar kind of corporation, raised the wages of their workers. This is a photo of May Day 1937, during the height of the Depression. And so the kinds of images you just saw were images that we could have shown you for almost any kind of industry during the 1930s. And it led to a huge increase in unionization. So if about 13% of American workers were in unions in 1930, by 1950, it was 35%. So instead of one in let's say 8 workers being in unions, more than 1 in 3 were in unions. So everybody knew about the union movement. I mean, if your mom or dad weren't in the union, your neighbor was in it. And sometimes, as one sociologist has suggested, organizing can lead to a great upsurge, not so much to be incremental, but all of a sudden something takes place, the conditions are right, and the organizing goes on by leaps and bounds. Hopefully we're in a period like that right now. Unfortunately, while the union movement grew, racism did not leave the union movement. This is Philadelphia, 1944, the Philadelphia Transit Strike. The Philadelphia Transit Company, basically the buses and the trolley cars of the day, had 11,000 workforce in 1944. A little more than 500 were African Americans. Since August of 1944, the company had been pressured to hire more Black workers, not only to hire more Black workers, but to promote them to jobs like motormen, instead of just having them be sort of the lowest level jobs at the lowest possible wages. The NAACP was pressuring the government, and the federal government was pressuring it as well for a number of reasons. One, this is still World War II, we're fighting fascism, and the United States is being seen as a racist society. It's not very good PR. But also, if there's a strike, that's harming war production. And Philadelphia, not only with the Navy Yard, but with a lot of factories, was an important source of war production. So when the company said they were going to to promote 8 of their workers to become motormen, the white workers went on strike, and for 7 days. There was no transportation in Philadelphia, which hurt the war effort because workers didn't have cars. The federal government had legislation if that happened during the war, and FDR sent in federal troops. And if the workers didn't come back to work, not only would they be fired, but they'd also be drafted, which was a pretty severe punishment for many of them. So FDR sent in 5,000 soldiers. There was no major violence. The city papers were against the strike, and the strike ended, and the workers were trained. This is a photo in a week or two after the strike. They had members of the army just riding in the buses and the trolleys just in case there would be problems. But that solved the strike, and it brought Philadelphia, for really bad, you know, racist reasons, to national attention in 1944. Historian James Wolfinger, who wrote about the strike demonstrated that profound racial cleavages that divided the working class, not just in the South, but was also across the nation in the North as well. Post-World War II, as I mentioned before, post-World War I, a conservative Congress, the big business community, concerned about the gains that workers had made. Remember, now we're talking about 35% of the workforce is unionized. Workers are getting good contracts. Now repression sets in. We have what came to be called McCarthyism. It could be called Trumanism. Truman started the loyalty oaths. And this is a photo of members of the United Electrical Workers Union, one of the most radical and integrated of the CIO unions, demonstrating in Chicago against the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is trying to stop their strike against McCormick Corporation. As a result of legislation that the government passed in 1947, became more and more difficult for unions to organize. And a lot of the radical members of the CIO, including communists, were thrown out of their unions. And the CIO became more and more conservative, more similar to the AFL. And in 1955, both federations merged into the AFL-CIO union. For 24 years, the president of the AFL-CIO was George Meany, a very conservative guy who bragged that he never walked a picket line. He refused to develop union programs to stop discrimination against women. Women protested. They formed the Coalition of Labor Union Women. And here's something that Dr. King spoke to the AFL-CIO in 1961. Our needs are identical with labor needs: decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, old age security, health and welfare measures, education for their children, and respect in the community. That is why Negroes support labor's demands and fight laws which curb labor. That is why the labor hater and labor baiter is virtually always a twin-headed creature spewing anti-Negro epithets from one mouth and anti-labor propaganda from the other mouth. It didn't seem to change Meany. And in 1963, only two of 35 executive members of the AFL-CIO endorsed the March on Washington. And I should say the March on Washington was called a March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The two members who endorsed it were Walter Reuther of the UAW and A. Philip Randolph, who we mentioned earlier, the head of the sleeping car porters. Just to bring us closer to the present time, I just want to show you some data. So from the end of World War II to almost 1980, as you can see, income growth was fairly steady and similar throughout the whole income spectrum. So the bottom 20% saw their income increase by 116%, the top 20% by almost 100%, and roughly the same in the middle. It was a period of time that American manufacturing was number one in the world. Remember that European industry, Japanese industry had been destroyed. So US corporations didn't have very much competition. They were doing very well. Workers could get relatively good contracts. There was something that was called sort of the social contract, the expectation that workers would continue to be hired. They would have unions as long as they didn't go out on strike. So that's a period of time that I grew up in, and it sort of seemed like everything was getting better. There was also the civil rights movement during that particular period of time. Things changed dramatically by 1980, the period of time that we're living in now. So from 1979 to really the present time, the bottom 20% has done worse. The top 1% is doing very well. The top 20% doing well. And those in the middle not doing so well, not doing so well at all. Union density, which refers to the percentage of workers who are on unions, has declined dramatically from the 1970s to the present time. Now roughly about 10% of the labor force is in unions. And a lot of that is because, if you see the purple on the upper right, has to do with the organization of federal, state, and local workers, which really didn't get started until the 1970s. So about one third of government workers are in unions, less than 10% of workers in the private sector. And a lot of that has to do with deindustrialization. A lot of that also has to do with anti-labor legislation. And a lot of it has to do with the Democratic Party becoming more and more conservative. So President Clinton signed NAFTA, which was very much opposed by the labor union movement, but Clinton went ahead and did it anyway. And that led to a lot of jobs being taken outside of the United States, good union jobs. And he also signed an anti-welfare bill, which hurt a lot of poor people, put a lot more people in jail for longer periods of time. And you can see that over time, the Democratic Party, which had seemed to be the party of workers, the party of the poor, no longer seemed to be that as well. And just a couple of comments, even this year at the Democratic convention, there was no space given during the convention for Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, who represents more than 12 million active and retired union workers from 55 unions. So what's kind of happened is the union movement has basically been taken for granted by the Democratic Party, and it no longer seems to have much leverage within, and being mostly a two-party system, the labor union seems to have, unions leadership seem to have nowhere else to go, though the union members have been going, and that's one of the reasons I think why Donald Trump was able to be successful in 2016. A significant number of union members, particularly white union members, who voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, moved to Trump, believing some of his rhetoric about bringing jobs back. You can see where the U.S. is as compared to other countries around the world in terms of union membership. It's very low. With the decline of union power, we saw income inequality increasing, and here you can see the result of discrimination, mostly in housing, because most of the median wealth that whites have is in the homes that they own, and this got even worse with the housing crisis of 2008. For many, this is what Labor Day is. Though in Philadelphia, there are Labor Day celebrations, Labor Day parades. This is from a parade just a few years ago of postal workers. And just in terms of the possibility of social movements making changes in the United States, there's the Fight for 15, the Black Lives Matter movement, the strikers in West Virginia, teachers striking in West Virginia, a lot of other red states a year or two ago. And I should say a lot of this were wildcat strikes. That is, teachers not waiting for their unions to say to go on strike, but going on strike anyway. And so I think one of the hopes for the future is that young people and middle-aged people and old people will sort of not wait for the leader to tell them what to do, but they'll decide what to do. And then finally, American athletes. This is the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team, which started the strike. I think I've talked much too long. I probably took that term sermon a little bit too loosely. So why don't I stop there, and we'll just leave it at that. If there are questions or discussion later, I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you so much, Maynard, for putting in context the kind of conditions we see today, not just the rhetorical atmosphere we live in, but the real practical economic atmosphere we live in. but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment that calls us not just to do a job, but to do the work of building a glorious golden city envisioned by the seers of old and the visionaries of today. This light, this warmth, this fire, we carry always in our hearts and into our world to share with those whose lives we touch, whose lives touch ours. And our closing words this morning are from Unitarian minister, Reverend Peter Rabel, who passed away in 2004. He was a crusader for social justice who embodied the principle that we should practice what we preach. His paraphrase of Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 10 to 12, seems a fitting close to this morning's service because it reminds us how we are bound together with those upon whose work we build our lives, our communities, our world. We build on foundations we did not lay. We warm ourselves at fires we did not light. We sit in the shade of trees we did not plant. We drink from wells we did not dig. We profit from persons we do not know. We are ever bound in community. And before we sing our closing song, I want to add a little context here, a content that helps us realize the link between the struggle for justice and democratic process and our aspirations for spiritual growth. Our closing song began its long life as an American folk spiritual, I Shall Not Be Moved, sung from before the Civil War to today. There are several contemporary groups that you know of who have made recordings of this. Its inspiration was a passage from the book of Jeremiah in the Old Testament of the Christian Bible, proclaiming that the person who trusts in God will be like a tree planted by the water that extends its roots by a stream and will not fear when the heat comes, but its leaves will be green and will not be anxious in a year of drought, nor cease to yield fruit. This spiritual was adapted by labor activists in the 1930s, with lyrics changed to, we shall not be moved. This is very similar to how I shall overcome became we shall overcome, taking on the collective voice of protest rather than its original singular voice claiming that the world would not divert me from my singular pursuit of salvation. This is no small matter when we think of our UU faith and how we practice it. That is, not only with faith in the self and its efforts to grow spiritually, emotionally, and intellectually, but also with faith in the worth of others and in the value of collective efforts to build a more just, peaceful, and verdant world. In short, as our gathering song said, not only to make our own days glad, but to build the common good. Now, this song, I have to warn you, there's no introduction here. When this video starts of We Shall Not Be Moved, performed by Pete Seeger, and I think it's the Almanac Singers, actually, you immediately start singing. But don't worry, because it's pretty easy to get on board with this song, We Shall Not Be Moved.
The union is behind us. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved. Together,
we shall not be moved.
We will stand and fight together.
We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water.
black and white together.
We shall not be moved just like a tree.